Welcome to Court and Controversy. I'm Janine Yunus. On this program, I'll be discussing a wide variety of controversial topics with some of the most original thinkers of our time, and no holds barred. I bring a litigator's perspective, and my guests will come from different backgrounds and industries. Enjoy the show. My guest today is Alex Berenson, former New York Times reporter, novelist, and he writes the Unreported Truth Substack. I became aware of Alex pretty early on in the COVID era. I think he was probably the first or second person I knew who was skeptical of the government's lockdown and restriction approach to COVID. And so I wanted to have him on to discuss that and many other matters. So first, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. I went to Yale, and then I worked for the Denver Post for a few years, and then I went to the New York Times. Or I worked actually for thestreet.com in there, which is still around. It's an online financial website that was going to put the Wall Street Journal out of business, but never did. And then I worked for the Times for like 10 years and had a great career as far as I was concerned. It was fun. Was interesting, and I wound up writing a spy novel about halfway through called The Faithful Spy, and one day I woke up and it was number one on the Times paperback bestseller list, and I was like, I may be doing something else in a couple of years. And so I spent most of the aughts, the teens, the 2010s, writing spy novels. And then in 2019, I wrote a book called Tell Your Children, which was about cannabis and how cannabis is probably much more psychiatrically dangerous than people want to admit. And maybe legalization isn't the best idea, and it's not medicine in any conceivable way. And people really didn't like that book. And actually that kind of set me up for COVID, because I thought that my like history at the Times, which was really quite, you know, I didn't leave with any flies on me. I thought people would take the book as a serious work of nonfiction, which is what it is. And instead it was like, this is a polemic and he doesn't understand science. And the book doesn't say that, you know, like cannabis shouldn't be legal. I don't particularly think legalization is a great idea. And it certainly doesn't say a lot of people should go to jail for it. But it does say, like, look at the science around this and you'll see this is a much more serious drug and the side effects are much more potent than we're acknowledging. Let's acknowledge that and then decide if legalization is a good idea. And
wait, let me
back
up. That
made people crazy.
Okay. Let's come back to that.
Yes.
So what did you write it for at the Times? I mean, what was your specialty?
I was a business and investigative reporter. Okay. Mostly. I did go to Iraq a couple times for the paper, and I did various other things. But for the bulk of my career, for my first few years, I was more financial investigative, and then I covered the drug industry, played a big part in my views on the vaccines in particular.
Okay. So did that lead you to your cannabis?
No, it was actually my wife, who's a forensic psychiatrist who treats she was running the forensic unit at a place called Mid-Hudson, which is in New York State, which is an institute for the criminally mentally ill. So if you're found not guilty, essentially by reason of insanity, you'll get sent there. So she had a view that, I mean, it wasn't a view. Most of the people who she treated had used cannabis, often quite heavily, in the past.
Oh, wow.
And so she was like, look, there's a real issue here. And I was actually skeptical of it. And she, I talk about this in the book, says to me, you really should look at the studies. And when I did look at the studies, I was stunned how strong the evidence of this connection is.
And what's is it like people are smoking weed and then going out and doing stuff? Or is it more like it's having long-term deleterious effects that are leading to it?
So, I mean, I think, you know, everybody knows that people who've become unmotivated or have, you know, sort of poor memories, or that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about long-term use. Well, first of all, cannabis can cause temporary psychosis. I don't even think the biggest backer of it would disagree with that. So that you can, you know, people who have anxiety attacks that lead them to, you know, have to go to the ER after they take an edible.
Right.
I mean, technically, they've really suffered an episode of cannabis psychosis.
Right.
Okay. And usually that's transient, right? I mean, it's almost always transient. But long-term use, especially if it starts when you're in your teens, and especially if it's daily use or it's use of you know, the THC extracts that are, you know, pure THC or more potent strains, there's a very clear connection to the development of permanent psychotic disorders, especially schizophrenia, which is a really terrible disease. Now, most people who use cannabis don't get this or get near it. And so, you know, people say to me, well, I've smoked my whole life. I've never had a problem. My friends smoke. They've never had problems. Yes, that's true for most people most of the time. But on a societal basis, if you allow or encourage the use of this by, especially by teenagers, there's a non-trivial number of people who are going to be hurt.
Right. Well, I mean, just to play devil's advocate, could it be correlative rather than causative?
So this is the thing that people have said to me ever since the book came out and before. Yeah. You don't understand, correlation is not causation. Like, the whole book is about this effort to try to, like, untangle this. And there's various ways to do that. So, I mean, one thing people don't understand about tobacco and lung cancer, and tobacco causes lung cancer.
Yeah.
Right? There's never been a study proving that tobacco causes lung cancer. It's just the epidemiology. It's the dose response. It's the fact that there's chemicals in tobacco that are known to be carcinogens. Ultimately, the strength of the evidence is too strong, even though it's essentially circumstantial.
Right.
And it's sort of the same thing with cannabis and psychosis, although the baseline, the rate ratio is lower, meaning the extra risk is lower, and the baseline risk of psychosis is also quite low. So it's kind of hard to see this unless you look. But when you look, and you can do studies where you look at a large group of people and you check their psychotic symptoms at baseline, then you see who uses and who doesn't. And you see what their psychotic symptoms look like a year later. Then you see who uses and doesn't. You check their psychotic symptoms a year later. And so you see whether or not use is driving these symptoms, whether symptoms are driving use. There's now, you know, there's brain scans that show, you know, real brain changes following heavy use. Now, that's, I'm not going to say that you can scan somebody's brain and tell whether or not they're psychotic simply from that. You can't. What I'm saying is that's a form of evidence. The evidence has mounted over the years, and I think that an honest look at this would say we're not at tobacco and lung cancer, but we're pretty close to that at this point. Wow.
And do you think there's a motivation to sort of hide that evidence?
Yeah, because it's bad for legalization. I mean, if you look at the drugs that people dislike the most, methamphetamine is, you know, people don't like meth. I mean, people don't like opioids because they kill people. But methamphetamine and the psychedelics, you know, especially the hard psychedelics, LSD, drugs that cause psychosis are frightening to people.
Right.
And so it's bad for legalization if cannabis is associated with that. Now, again, you could say, okay, well, like, there's a very small number of people who are going to get this de novo as a result of this. I'm not interested in having this drug be criminalized for that reason. We have the number one thing people say, and it's a good counter argument, is alcohol causes all kinds of problems. Yeah. Alcohol causes violence. Alcohol kills people. Alcohol's legal. Why shouldn't cannabis be legal? And my answer to that, yes, I don't disagree with any of that. But there's two answers. First of all, we tried to prohibit alcohol.
Right.
It didn't work. Because, that's right. Because half the country or more adults drink, you know, at least occasionally. Cannabis isn't like that. It's become more like that, but it's still much more of a niche drug than alcohol. So and in other societies, it's used even less.
Right.
So we do have a choice about this. And the other reason is just because alcohol causes problems, do we want cannabis to cause problems like that? So I think, look, the number one reason, I mean, there's many reasons I wrote the book, but the number one reason I wrote the book is I'm not a big fan of public policy that's based on, like, myths and hope and lies, as you know.
Yeah.
Even if it feels good. And so the notion that cannabis was legalized initially in California and elsewhere on the basis that it was medically valuable.
Yeah.
It is not medically valuable. It's a smoked product. Okay, so for that reason alone,
It doesn't have to be. It could be vaped or eat edibles.
Yes, but when this was happening, it essentially was a smoked product. And nobody says tobacco is good for you. Okay?
Right.
So this notion that cannabis is medicine is just a lie. Okay. And when it's been tested on almost anything, or the extract, THC, has been tested against almost any condition, it doesn't work. It reminds me a little bit of ivermectin, which I shouldn't say. I'll get in trouble. The people who are fans of it, they'll say it does anything.
Yeah.
Okay.
So my aunt swears by it. She had cancer. She claims it.
Ivermectin or cannabis?
No, cannabis, not ivermectin. That would be a new one. I don't think anyone said that.
The condition that cannabis cures is called not being high. Okay. So if we're going to legalize it, let's legalize it for the reason that people like recreational drugs. People want to be able to make their own choices. People, you know, again, alcohol is legal. And so if I want to sit in my house and get stoned, I should be allowed to do that and you shouldn't bother me.
Yeah.
And I think
that's my position. So, I honestly think heroin should be legal, but
like, that's a terrible idea. Heroin kills lots of people. I mean, and so like anything that encourages the societal use of heroin has to be considered very carefully. And cannabis is not heroin. Okay.
It's not.
Yeah, but the principle of, This is not just your decision because there's societal consequences does apply.
Yeah, you can say that about anything, though. I mean, yeah. And that's the argument for forcing people to get the vaccine, too, is the externalities. I mean, of course.
But this is totally different because the vaccine didn't work.
Well, that's true. So, yeah.
Yes. I mean, no, I agree. When people say to me, you sound like a libertarian on a lot of things, you know, you're pro-choice, even though you don't really, you know, you have lots of objections to abortion. Personally, I say it's true. You know, they say drugs are the only issue where you're not really following your own principles. And my counter argument to that is the correct way to look at the drug user, the individual user, is as a polluting chemical factory. Well, here's what I mean. People use drugs because they get pleasure out of it, right? I mean, ultimately. And then they become addicted, some of them. But even then, the pleasure they're getting overcomes for them the desire to quit, the ability. Right. Either you could say desire or ability, okay? Because people do quit. They quit everything sometimes. Sometimes they die. Sometimes they moderate their use. Mostly with the quote-unquote hard drugs, eventually they die or quit, okay? So they're getting the pleasure. The rest of us are dealing with the consequences of their use. So they are the polluter, making
you could
the money.
Say the same thing
we
about,
are cleaning up after
you
that.
Could say, well, first of all, you could say the same thing about alcoholics, but also about fast food. People who are obese or eat fast food,
it's much harder. Like, people who eat fast food don't usually like neglect their children and or abuse their children because of their fast food.
That's true. Yeah. But their health problems are very costly for society, one could argue.
I think you can draw a distinction between drugs and fast food.
Well,
I'm gonna go to the map for that.
I might disagree with you on that one, but we do need to talk about COVID.
We can talk about drugs all day.
So you're obviously one of the most well-known COVID dissidents. You're probably the first one I knew about, you and Jeffrey Tucker, I think. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Like, what was your initial reaction to COVID and how that evolved?
Sure. So, I mean, it's interesting because the drug, the cannabis book actually plays a real role in this. So in the fall of 2019, the cannabis book, which is called Tell Your Children, had come out a few months before. I was actually working on a book more generally about drug use and this analogy that I like and everyone else hates of the chemical plant. And but sort of this idea that the sort of legalization lobby has seized the moral high ground and nobody argues it's big picture as to why drug use probably should not be encouraged or allowed to be legal. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's what I'm working on. And all of a sudden, like everybody else in January 2020, I start hearing about COVID or this virus in China, and everybody's getting sick, and the Chinese are closing, they're closing the whole province, they're closing multiple provinces, they're closing flights, except not the flights to the United States, and it seems pretty clear it's going to be a big thing. And for a while, I was actually quite worried about it. People sometimes they go back and they look at my tweets, they're like, you said, like, yeah, I did. Like, and then I like very rapidly sort of figured out what was really going on. And so,
yeah, I'm glad I wasn't on Twitter because I'm actually a huge hypochondriac. So I was really,
you were really,
yeah, I was, there was a point in my life I was like terrified of Ebola and I was certain I was going to die of Ebola. So
see, you get older and you realize, A, you're just going to die anyway. Exactly. And B, this stuff, it's going to be, you know, cancer or heart attack. It's, yeah. So anyway, I was concerned, and then I'll never forget. I talk about it in Pandemia, which is the book that I wrote that came out in December 2021, about COVID and my experience. I think it was March 16th, and I was reading the Neil Ferguson report, the famous report that predicted, you know, there'd be 2 million deaths in the United States without immediate suppression and 500,000 in the UK. And really, the report that provided the intellectual underpinnings for lockdown.
Yeah.
I mean, it was happening. It happened in Italy. It happened in France and Spain within a few days. And as we learned, Neil Ferguson was running around to those countries sort of encouraging them. And as we learned also, and this was true, I think, in New York City also, many, many of the deaths early on were in nursing homes caused by panic. You know, whether the staffs just, I mean, they walked out en masse in places in northern Italy. They just literally, like, the, you know, a lot of those people were from Eastern Europe, and they just went back. They just left these people to die. I mean, that really did happen. And it happened in New Jersey, too. I mean, it was you know, not exactly that way, but close to that way. So the panic is mounting, and I read this report, and I'm like, this is crazy. Like, if you look at the numbers here, he didn't have the infection fatality ratio is explicitly explained by age, but you could back calculate it.
Yeah.
And it was extraordinarily clear that the death gradient was off the charts, that you know, that if you were under 50, you were at very low risk. If you were under 30, you were at no risk from this. And if you were, you know, over 80, yes, then you could really die. I mean, you had a 5 or 10% chance of dying.
Right. And so did you not care about grandma?
I didn't think that we should shut the world down for grandma. I'm sorry. You know, that's not. And it also was clear that if this is the case, then this isn't that serious physically for most people. This is a medical problem, not a societal problem. Okay. So over the next few days, and then, you know, the panic increased, and I started to read more and more and more.
Was this was like March?
This was mid-March. So
were you in the New York area?
I was in the New York area, and Cuomo, you know, he said he'd never close the schools, or he'd never, de Blasio said he'd never close the schools. They closed, you know, days later.
Yeah.
Cuomo said he'd never shut down New York. It closed.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my wife is a physician, and she's a psychiatrist, but she's a physician. And the you know, the hospitals were getting ready for this tsunami of cases. And then Neil Ferguson, less than 10 days after he made this incredible, horrific prediction of 500,000, he said, oh, it's going to be 25,000, which was also wrong, it turned out.
Yeah.
But and it was like nobody in the U.S. paid attention to this. And then when they did, it was, oh, it's because we locked down. It's like, no, it's not. He made that prediction 10 days ago. Assuming like that there would be a lockdown, and it was still going to be too late.
Yeah.
So I was like, what is going on here? And then the third thing, and this is really what got me noticed, along with the Neil Ferguson prediction, was in New York State, Andrew Cuomo would have these press conferences every day, and the press conferences, he would make these predictions, or, you know, he would tell you how many cases there had been, how many deaths there had been. And he would put up a chart with a prediction of how many cases and hospitalizations and ICU cases there would be in a few days. And these were horrific predictions.
Yeah.
Okay. The predictions were that 50 or 60,000 people in New York, maybe it was 40 to 50. I could find the numbers.
I was in New York. So,
it was 40 to 50,000. Okay. And New York City or New York State had, you know, fewer than 20,000 hospital beds.
Yeah.
Okay. And 10,000 ICU patients. It would have been, the New York Times wrote a story saying there's going to be rationing of ventilators.
Yeah.
Right. And they're practicing putting two people on a ventilator at the same time. It was crazy in New York at the end of March. Okay. Yeah. And I looked at the chart and I said, okay, this looks really bad. And then I said, wait a minute. Today, March 31st, they're saying there's 12,000 people in hospital beds today. Yeah. And there's 4,000.
Yeah.
So his the prediction that he's using to make this apocalyptic prediction in a few days doesn't match the facts as they're being reported right now.
Right.
And every day for like 4 or 5 days, I did this. And I said, this is like, this may be bad, but this is not the apocalypse. Look at the gap between not what they what they're saying is going to happen in 2 weeks. Look at what's happening right now and how it doesn't match.
Yeah.
And so what this is, and this is telling you is like, even with that period of uncontrolled spread in New York in mid-March, even in a city that's, you know, very, very public transport dependent and is lots of apartments and where they were, people were queuing, you know, lining up to get tests and all passing into each other, even under the worst possible circumstances, yes, you're going to have some deaths.
Yeah.
But you are not going to collapse the medical system. The hospitals are not going to be overrun. And they were not overrun.
No.
And the hospital ships, I don't know if you remember the hospital.
I do remember.
They were empty.
And then what was it? Wasn't there some kind of hospital in the park?
Yes, there was a triage facility in the park that was empty. It was serious.
Yeah.
And people died, but it was, even at its absolute worst, so far from what they said it was going to be.
Yeah.
And so I started by saying that, and then I said, look, we got to open everything. Now,
when you say your objection to lockdowns was mainly because you thought that they would be more deadly in the long run or more harmful to society in the long run, or sort of civil liberties, just like you can't do this to people regardless?
It was both. It was, this is the United States. We're not doing this. It's, by the way, I don't think this works. And especially, here's the thing about lockdowns. They're too early or too late. Meaning too early, eventually you have to reopen. And unless you keep people locked down until you get to a vaccine.
Right.
Or a vaccine that actually works.
I was going to say.
Or you lock down forever. Eventually you're going to have to. Or actually a variant that's less dangerous. Which is really what bailed out the countries that had hard lockdowns.
Yeah.
Omicron came along. But so unless you lock down until that time, eventually you're going to have to reopen and people are going to get the virus anyway. Or you lock down too late, and this actually happened in New York City. You force people who've already been infected. We forced healthy people into the homes with their parents and grandparents.
Right.
They sickened and killed those people.
Right, right. So I mean, they brought all the college kids back.
That's right. Those kids should have given it to each other,
yeah,
along with everything else they give each other in college, although I guess they don't do that anymore. If you look at the fertility numbers, it's a whole different story. And they should have stayed in college.
Yeah.
So,
and then Cuomo will put all everybody.
And then he sent it to the nursing home. That's right. So another horrific decision,
and may have been for, you know, to the extent there was a higher death rate in New York than one would hope. That might have been the reason.
That was part of the reason. Listen, the ventilators were part of the reason. There was panic in the medical community, which led to poor care,
right,
and it was crystal clear that this was happening.
Yeah,
and yet any effort to have a conversation about any of this stuff was nearly impossible.
Well, why do you think that was? What, with your background in sort of taking apart propaganda and understanding the motivation for that?
I mean, I talk about it in the book a little bit. Clearly, there was some Trump hatred.
Yeah.
Clearly, but there was fear. There was real fear among, you know, some hypochondriacal journalists. Also, you know, it was New York City. There were people dying.
Yeah.
These hospitals, you know, some of the hospitals in Brooklyn and Queens, some of the municipal hospitals did have, you know, they did actually have, you know, refrigerated morgues. There were deaths. And so instead of people saying, like, what are all the factors that have gone into this? Is this actually what we'll see everywhere in the world if this happens, you know? Or maybe there's factors in New York City from everything, again, from the healthcare system itself to the fact that we shoved all these people back home. Maybe this is the worst case, and even this is not as bad as we were told it's going to be. There's just panic.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
So do you think, I always wonder, if Hillary Clinton had been president, what do you think would have happened? I know it's pure speculation.
I don't know. That's a good question. I tend to think about that from the other point of view, which is, had Trump won in 2020, would there have been more skepticism about the vaccines? Mm, and yeah. I'm almost sure there would.
There would have been. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's it. Well, we'll get to that soon.
So that was it. So, yeah. So, and here's the thing. Like, I think if you look back, I was right about almost all of it. Yeah. Now, there was one thing that I was certifiably wrong about, and I'm not going to say that I was wrong about like the death predictions, because nobody was saying that, you know, there'd be a million people dead except Neil Ferguson, and then he backed off. People say, oh, you said 60,000 people would die. That was when, you know, Fauci said 60,000 people right. would die. And also, who knew we were going to count, you know, forever with this? I actually, in my first Unreported Truths booklet, I said up to 600,000 people could die. And I think if you actually look at what the real number is, not the like overcounting, yeah. I think the U.S. really was in the 600,000 to 700,000
right.
range.
Because a lot of the deaths were not really from COVID, ultimately. They were people who would have died soon of something because they were very ill.
Yes, yes. Saying. So I said all this stuff, but I was aggressive about yeah. it. Let's be honest, okay?
And I remember.
And, you know, some of the Department of Pandemia stuff, yeah. like there were people dying, and some of it, like sometimes my tone was mocking.
Yeah.
Not of the people who were dying,
yeah.
but of all of it.
Yeah. You're the one who came up with the Team Reality,
Team Apocalypse.
Yeah,
yes.
Yes. Yes. You actually coined the...
I did. And, you know, and so, I mean... Look, I'm not Jay Bhattacharya, okay? I'm not an academic. And Jay's a nice guy. Maybe I'm not as nice, okay? But sometimes people would say...
Definitely not on Twitter.
Definitely not on Twitter. No, I mean, Jay's a nice guy through and through.
Yeah, yeah.
But people say to me, oh, well, you know, like, you should have been more like that. And I say, and, you know, that's why people didn't like you. And I say, they try to get Jay fired.
Yeah.
It's not. No. You know what? You might as well be the person you are, because they went after everybody
oh,
who
yeah.
disagreed.
I mean, I think it takes all types. I don't think, you know, and yeah, Martin and Jay's strategy isn't, you know, they're not really rhetorical rhetoricians. They're sort of, you know, science guys.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So then, you know, sort of the next thing was masks, obviously, and you were a pretty, I read your book on that, and I hated masks. Man. I have to admit, I just have like a visceral, like also a vanity reaction, like I don't really want to cover up my face.
Who wants it? No, masks are a joke.
Yeah.
They're a joke. And listen, even N95s, they don't really work.
Yeah.
But the entire country was going to wear two properly fitted N95s a day at a cost of $1 billion
yeah.
a day. It's insanity.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just purely from a common sense perspective, it makes no sense at all. One thing, a surgeon who's performing an operation, which by the way, they don't even wear surgical masks to stop that viruses, as
no,
you probably know.
No, so you don't spit on them.
Yeah. But that's a totally different thing than expecting people, including children, to wear them throughout their day. And the idea, I mean, as soon as they had the rules where you would like walk up to the table and take them, I was like, oh my God, no one actually believes
it. It's funny. People always point to that. Like, yes, you could walk through and then you sit down. No. Look, beyond that, there had been work done on this in the PC, in the pre-COVID era, when you could actually have scientific discussions
yeah.
about the right ways to deal with a pandemic, or, you know, flu vaccines don't really work on old people, so maybe we should give them to young people instead. Like, I mean, which I don't think is a great idea, but like you could have discussions about the fact that certain interventions didn't really work very well and how would you use them.
Yeah.
You couldn't have that anymore. But in the pre-COVID era, it was very clear that surgical masks were useless. And in fact, yeah. as you know, since you read the booklet, there were two amazing arbitration cases in Canada where judges,
right.
because the nurses in the old days didn't like wearing
yeah.
the mask and certainly didn't think they should have to wear them. This was for flu. And so they sued the nurses' union to prevent hospitals from requiring them to wear masks or get the flu vaccine.
Yeah.
And an arbitrator looked at the evidence and decided the nurses were correct, that the masks were useless. And
yeah.
that was essentially the state of the science, including with our friend, you know, the sainted Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is science, as we know. He admitted this too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so you got on that early as well.
Yes.
And then the vaccines were the next thing.
No, the next thing was school closures.
Oh, okay.
So
I had sort of put that in the same category as lockdowns. But yeah.
But I'd say it's a different thing. And it's the thing that I'm proudest of, actually,
okay, yeah,
because
yeah.
I think that was where the politics was the worst, and yeah. where the media hysteria was the worst. And, and I really am, somebody needed to stand up, and we lost. Okay. For the most part. I mean, except in Florida, except in some of the red states, Trump, people forget Trump wanted the schools open in June of 2020. And the teachers unions just absolutely wouldn't let him. And to this day, it's not clear to me whether they just didn't understand the science, which was clear by then, not just that kids didn't get sick, but this idea, making teachers go to school. Teachers were actually safer in school because kids cleared the virus so quickly. They actually didn't spread it very much. So that was clear too. It was clear that long, MISC, this sort of post-COVID infection syndrome in kids was nonsense. And so did the teachers not understand the science? Did they not care because they wanted to beat Trump and they thought this would punish him? Or did they just think that this was a nice way for them to stay at home and do nothing?
Yeah, I think I was actually dating a teacher at the time, and he was like, I mean, it's honestly a New York City teacher. Their lives are kind of miserable. They don't make, I mean, they make a decent living actually compared to teachers in other parts of the country. But, they don't make a ton of money. He had to get up at like 5 a.m. They're all day, like didn't even have time to go to the bathroom because you have no time between classes. So, I mean, he was really kind of thrilled. And I think it's hard. I think it's hard for people to admit to themselves that they're advocating for a policy because it's benefiting them personally, So I think a lot of people just weren't really being honest. And then, that's one reason the teachers were so sort of vociferous about their objections to school reopening.
Yes. And it was terrible for kids. Okay.
Yeah, of course.
Terrible. And so, I mean, the thing that I'm personally proudest of, of those 2 years is that our kids didn't suffer. Okay. And now we had a problem with the school, the school they went to first a private school nearby, which had ridiculous rules.
Were you already, you were upstate, right? You were in the city.
Yes. So, yeah. And then we moved our older daughter to the local public school, which is excellent and had fewer restrictions. But outside of the restrictions that the school forced upon us, our kids lived as normally as we possibly could. And so, I live in Putnam County, New York, there's a Walmart, I live a real like American life, a lot of driving, a lot of big box store shopping. And we would always tell the kid, like, look, you're in the Walmart, you got to wear the mask. I mean, our 2-year-old, we didn't.
Yeah.
But you got to know that this is nonsense. There's nothing to be scared of. They're just making you do this. It's not really okay, but we're just going to deal with it. And our kids were not scared. They had no emotional issues as a result of COVID. They viewed it as a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And so, and parents really did screw up their kids.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, as a lifelong hypochondriac, it's not fun. When I watched people do this to their kids over COVID, I was like, you're gonna regret this.
Yeah.
Okay, so then the vaccines, that's almost probably what your sort of biggest, right?
I thought I was hated in 2020. No. Okay, so the vaccines. I was sort of aware that this was happening, that the vaccines were being tested. And I knew that the flu vaccine didn't work very well. So I just assumed that they wouldn't really work. I had not studied the mRNA technology. Yeah. The results come back November 2020. It's 90% effective. It's 95% effective. And once again, for about 5 minutes, I was fooled. And I was like, this is great. And I'm not an anti-vaxxer.
Yeah.
I feel the need to say that. I mean, even saying it is in some way like conceding ground.
Yeah.
But because you have to define yourself. But my kids have all been vaccinated with the standard childhood vaccines, all of them.
Yeah.
Now, on the schedule, even. Some people, I'm going to mess with it. You know what? Like, whatever. You're getting the vaccine, get the vaccine.
we're not doing the schedules.
So, fair enough.
Seems like too many of the
too same. Many vaccines. I mean, now I think I'd have more questions, but I don't have enough questions to not actually do it. So I start looking at the clinical trial results.
And is this for any of the one in particular, or
this is for Pfizer and Moderna, okay, the big two, right? Yeah. The 40,000 person clinical trial for Pfizer, the 30,000 person clinical trial for Moderna. Yeah. The Pfizer trial, you know, has been conducted by Pfizer sort of independently. The Moderna trial is run under Warp Speed, but is, you know, Moderna still runs it. It's still the it's still Moderna's product, and the two vaccines are functionally the same, right? Moderna has a slightly higher dosage, but they're functionally the same vaccine. And so, and everyone always calls it Pfizer, even though it's actually BioNTech's vaccine, but we'll just call it Pfizer. So, and here's what hits me. There are 40,000 people in this clinical trial for Pfizer. 20,000 get the vaccine, 20,000 got placebo. COVID kills old people.
Yeah.
Right? If you want to know if the vaccine or any treatment actually works against COVID, you have to test it against the population at risk. I think there were 100 people in each arm over 80.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, I want to double check that number, but it is very close to right. And there were essentially no people over 85. Okay. Yeah. And that's not because they couldn't have enrolled those people. They could have gone to nursing homes and enrolled them pretty easily. When the monoclonal antibodies were tested, they were tested against people actually at risk. And that's why there's almost no, there were, I believe, two deaths from COVID in the placebo arm out of the 20,000 volunteers. There were no deaths or one death from the, in the vaccine arm. Okay.
Right. So it's statistically insignificant.
Exactly. Right? And overall deaths, were slightly higher in the placebo arm and then over time became slightly higher in the COVID arm, but no real difference. Okay. When overall, when I say overall deaths, I mean all-cause mortality deaths from heart attacks, accidents, whatever it is. Which frankly, if you're giving a treatment to a large population of healthy people, that's what matters more than anything else, right? It's not, does it save my life from COVID if it then kills me from something else? It's, does it overall improve the population health?
Right.
Okay. But that, put that aside, we're talking about the number of people who were at high risk who got this.
Right.
And the number was essentially zero, very close to zero. And once I saw that, I knew the game was rigged and I knew what had happened, which is, these people had spent a year terrifying the world and especially the, you know, the left and the Biden base about COVID. They needed to give people something to get them out of this.
Yeah.
The vaccines do produce an immune response. No one disputes that. And in the very short term, they actually reduce the number of COVID infections because they produce this huge antibody response and you temporarily are protected from COVID, which means you're temporarily protected from dying from COVID.
Yeah.
If you don't get COVID, you can't die from COVID. And that was why they tested it the way they did. They wanted an approvable product and they got it.
Yeah.
And then they immediately went crazy pushing it to everybody. Had they either tested it properly, in other words, tested it on the population at risk, or said in December 2020, look, we're going to continue testing this. We think that, you know, if you're over 70 or over 60, you know, some reasonable number, we think it's a really good idea for you to get this. And everybody else, let's you know, maybe we'll make it available. I mean, a lot of people would have taken it anyway, but I wouldn't have even done that. I would have said, we're going to wait until we know more and let the safety, you know, data come in and we're going to test, you know, we're going to, you don't need this.
Yeah.
You just don't need this because COVID doesn't kill you anyway. So we're going to do a phased rollout, but that was not what they put themselves in a position where they needed to answer the problem.
Right, right. And then, I mean, so then, you know, to play devil's advocate, well, why not just get it? What's the big deal? Maybe it doesn't do anything, but what's the harm?
So, okay, the big deal is it's a pharmaceutical product. It's not a placebo. So you don't know what it does long term. Now, there was a notion that no vaccine had ever caused long-term effects, that any problem would be seen within 42
days.
That's
ridiculous. Wasn't there the DTaP in... Wasn't there some version of it that was killing kids at a pretty high rate?
I don't want to go there because I think I know what you're talking about, but I'm not sure. There was many years ago, there was a problem with the inactivated polio virus turning out not to be so inactivated. Yeah. My point would be the mRNA was a completely novel product, a completely novel modality, and you don't know what the long-term effects are going to be.
So what about the J&J?
The J&J was also quite novel. Yeah. And as it turned out, both of these products had, I mean, they killed some people. Okay. Yeah. The J&J with the central
blood clots.
Yeah. Central venous sinus thrombosis is a terrible way to die. Your brain, like, basically you get a giant blood clot in the middle of it. And the Pfizer and Moderna products cause myocarditis, which kills, you know, I'm not going to say it kills a lot of people, but they did kill some people. And those, and the people they killed, unfortunately, were young and healthy for the most part, and thus at almost no risk from COVID. So it's not a joke when you tell people to take a powerful pharmaceutical product.
So that's
my counter to this. Well, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
It did matter.
And I mean, I think that's why it's so outrageous to have taken choice away from people. At least as, I mean, so many people were forced to get it, you know, or they would lose their jobs if they didn't get it, which for a lot of people, you might as well force them.
So that's absolutely right. But that's actually, that's act two of this vaccine tragedy. Act one is you roll it out without really testing it on the people you need to test it on. And you give it to this fearful population and tell them it's going to solve COVID. Okay. You didn't know that the vaccine would only work for a few months. Maybe you should have, but you didn't. And you didn't know that there were these rare but fatal side effects, which you found out. Okay. Jump ahead to the summer of 2021. Okay. The summer of 2021, the vaccines start to fail. And it is incontrovertible in the data. Israel cases go way up. Israel was completely vaccinated with the mRNAs. Yeah. England used the mRNAs and the DNA vaccine, which was the J&J and the AstraZeneca vaccine. Cases are starting to go back up. Even in the U.S., we were slightly behind. Slightly, cases starting to go back up. Okay, what does the Biden administration do? This is where you go from, well, we were hopeful and we overpromised and, you know, we made a mistake, to something much darker, in my point of view. They do two things. They say everyone needs to get a booster.
Yeah. Okay.
There was no real safety data on this. And at this point, they knew or should have known that the booster was only going to be a temporary solution. So you're putting people on a treadmill, okay, with no idea of how many shots you're going to need or what the long-term impact of those shots is going to be. The mRNAs became vaccines because they were supposed to be essentially pharmaceutical products that would be taken regularly as, you know, for cancer or other chronic conditions. And it turned out that if you give people too many mRNA doses, it's not good for them. So the Biden administration just ignores this. And that led to a couple FDA officials resigning, which everyone forgets. Okay,
wasn't that over the adding it to the kids' schedule, or am I misremembering?
It was both. It was at the same time they resigned. It was late August 2021. Okay, so there's a medical scientific giant failure happening in the idea of this. You know what? Like, this product didn't work as promised, and our answer is going to be to give people more. Then what's the other side? What you just said. Mandates. Yeah. Boosters and mandates are two different issues, but they're both bad. Mandates are a political and constitutional nightmare.
Yeah.
And if let's say the vaccine was 100% effective at stopping infection and transmission. Okay. In that case, anybody who had gotten it wouldn't be at risk. But let's say again, there's this idea, really old people, they're not going to get the full protection from it. Kids who have immune conditions, they're compromised, they can't get it yet. We need to vaccinate everyone to protect those people. Okay, that's not how the United States works.
Yeah.
But you can at least make a sort of coherent moral argument there. Okay. The problem was, at the time the Biden administration introduced the mandates, it was September 2021. By that point, it was clear to anybody, including them, that the vaccines didn't stop infection, didn't stop transmission, and didn't work for very long.
Yeah.
So you're going to force competent adults to take a drug product That doesn't work.
Yeah, and they justified it by saying, because I actually worked on some cases, their justification was, well, maybe it doesn't stop transmission, but it prevents worker illness. So therefore, and I actually drew a similar analogy I made earlier to like, well, are you going to say people can't eat fast food because then that makes them unhealthy and they're...
but this is much worse, honestly, yeah, because this is forcing people to take something. And we have a really high bar for forcing medicines upon people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there, I thought there was a weird concerted effort to make it like vaccines are always completely safe, and you're a crazy person and a lunatic if you ever, and an anti-vaxxer if you ever say that maybe a vaccine could have side effects where the costs outweigh the benefits.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of the spring campaign.
Yeah.
And that actually worked for them because, again, there was this period, which I call in pandemic, the happy vaccine valley, where cases really did go down. You know, in Israel in particular, again, you can see it more clearly than anywhere else because it's a small country and they got everybody vaccinated practically. Yeah. There were days in June 2021 where nobody died and essentially there were fewer than 10 new cases of COVID. That's when Fauci and Walensky were saying things like, we can actually eliminate this. It stops transmission. I guess they actually believe that. Now, Pfizer never believed that. Pfizer's a lot smarter.
Yeah.
But that was hopeful and stupid.
Yeah.
What happened later was wrong.
Yeah. You mean what happened with mandates?
And boosters.
You know what they say in opposition is like, well, maybe the cases were going up, but it's really about decreasing the severity of the symptoms.
Yeah. So that is something that was rolled out after it became clear that the vaccines weren't going to eradicate COVID. Here's the problem. And like, this is an argument I hate to have. It's really, really complicated.
You're getting no argument from me. I'm just giving you the opposing.
But it's never been clear to me, and it's never been clear when you really get into the data deeply, that the vaccines work against severe disease and death once they stop working against infection and transmission. Mm-hmm. And going into why is really complicated and mind-numbing, but it is true. I'm not saying that with 100% certainty. There may be some benefit, but it is modest at best. The number one thing you need to understand about this, and that everyone needs to understand about this, is, and you, I'm sure you know this, but there's something called the healthy vaccine bias effect, and that is that people who take vaccines, this is sort of interesting, it's that, are generally healthier than people who don't take vaccines. And so they tend to have better outcomes. And the classic study about this is a study on flu deaths, influenza and pneumonia deaths. People who took the flu vaccine had far fewer influenza and pneumonia deaths, but they had far fewer influenza and pneumonia deaths both before and after receiving the flu vaccine.
Yeah.
They're just a healthier cohort. And in a group where 95% of people over 80 are getting vaccinated, you can't make any assumptions about the two groups.
Right.
So that's why you got to run clinical trials. And we never did. And you know, here's the thing. Like, I'll make this argument about vaccines. I'll make this argument about cannabis. I'll make this argument about ivermectin. Okay. I believe in clinical trials.
Yeah.
And I know they're not perfect. And I know there's lots of problems with them. But they're the best thing we got.
Yeah. 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 Okay. So... let's get to your case.
So
we both, or is there more you want
to
say?
No.
Okay. Yeah. So we both have cases, me as a lawyer and you as plaintiff. A client, but similar cases in which, my clients, Jay Bhattacharya, Martin Kulldorff, Aaron Cariotti, and Jill Hines, and you in your case were censored on, Twitter mainly. Also, they were also censored on LinkedIn. I don't know if you use other social media.
No, I was really a Twitter guy
at the behest of the government. And actually, I always say, I probably shouldn't say this, but I think they have a great First Amendment case. I think you have the best First Amendment case of anyone in America, because, except maybe RFK, but actually I think yours is still better, because you have direct proof that the government demanded Twitter censor you, and then Twitter did.
Yep.
So do you want to back up? Like, okay, first of all, what were you censored on and when? Which topics?
So, thank you for that. I think I have the best case too.
my clients should still win. Let me reiterate
and I hope
that,
they do. And it would have been sort of interesting if my case had been linked to yours cases. But um, so So Berenson v. Biden comes out of Berenson v. Twitter. Berenson v. Twitter comes out of my ban from Twitter. So in the summer of 2021, as things went crazy, Twitter started giving me strikes.
And that had never happened. That didn't happen with lockdowns or masks.
No. Yeah. And the opposite. Twitter actually came to me in May 2020 and said, we know you're controversial. We want to have nuanced discussions about this. And a senior person at Twitter. Yes. And Jack Dorsey knew about what was going on. And Twitter once called itself, not so very long ago, the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party, famously. And there was still some of that. I mean, as Elon likes to say, the woke mind virus had come in and, that sort of zombified Twitter, but not as badly as the other places. There was still this history. So for all of 2020, as people said, this guy's getting people killed and, everyone's got to wear masks and grandma, he hates grandma. Twitter stood by me, okay? And even after the vaccines came out, and I said to them, look, I'm going to write fact-based questions on the vaccines. They stood by me. They gave me a strike in April 2020. I later found out, but they didn't even notify me of it. It was a weird situation. It was like automated and came up. And the only reason I know that is because it was in... like early discovery.
What does it even mean to have a strike if you didn't know about it?
That's a great question. So they, in late 2020, early 2021, they introduced this five strike policy. And the first strike is just a warning. You don't get a timeout or anything, but child. So it was the first strike, meaning the second one would result in a, 6 hour or 12 hour penalty. I think it goes warning, 12 hour, 7 day, and then boom, you're gone. Permanent suspension. You can never come back.
Yeah. Right. Which for a lot of people was really a terrible idea. I know. I mean, like someone like you, it's not just, fun, right?
It was damaging to me personally. It was damaging to me as a journalist. It's a mark of Cain.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's like you're not permitted in the public sphere because your ideas are so bad and dangerous.
Right. I presume Twitter is sort of instrumental in your earning a living, right?
Twitter didn't, there was no real income stream from Twitter then. Now there is actually some, but it was a way for me to promote my books, promote the stack.
I knew about you because of Twitter.
Because of Twitter, that's right. And that's, ultimately Amazon, when I published the first booklet, which sold like 250,000 copies, like that was, that my name was because of Twitter. There's no question about it. So even if Twitter was not paying me directly, yes. So I get this first strike, which I don't even know about, and I'm continuing to be aggressive. And there's starting to be more evidence for myocarditis. Like I'm sort of loudly questioning the vaccines. And I will admit, in April and May, as cases were going down in Israel, I was like, wow, am I going to be forced into the most humiliating? And The Atlantic writes a piece about me. They say I'm the pandemic's strongest man. It was a terrible hit piece.
I didn't get a whole piece written about me, but I was quoted in a sort of,
snarky.
Where I said I wasn't going to get the vaccine because I just didn't think there was enough data.
And you were totally correct. Okay. And the Biden administration at this point has already approached Twitter. That actually might have been why I got that first strike. I'd have to go back and check the timing exactly. But in April, Andy Slavitt, who I had mocked mercilessly, it was definitely personal for him.
Yeah.
It was also political for him.
Yeah.
And he's a very senior person in the, in the White House. His title was senior advisor to the COVID response team, meaning he reports to Jeff Zients, who at the time, who's now the chief of staff for Joe Biden, at the time was reporting to Ron Klain, who was Biden's chief of staff. So Andy Slavitt is three steps from the president, not big steps. Yeah. Okay. Slavitt and Rob Flaherty are having meetings in April 2020.
Yeah.
Or I'm sorry, 2021.
Yeah.
And with the social media companies. Flaherty, I think, is sort of more concerned at that time about Facebook Yeah. Slavitt is more concerned about Twitter. You know, Twitter's Facebook is much bigger. Twitter's where the, you know, the journalists talk to each other. It's a little bit more where the sausage gets made. And and I'm arguably the most like important anti-vax voice on Twitter. You know, RFK is the most important on Facebook. I'm the most important on Twitter. I think that's a fair
argument.
And Slavitt tells Twitter, he says, you know, the way they record this is Andy Slavitt asked a really tough question about why Alex Berenson is still on the platform.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is the equivalent of the cop saying to you, can you get out of your car for me, please? Now, you can maybe say no or maybe not, but it's, you have to have a lot of presence of mind to even know that you can say no.
Yeah.
And be willing to deal with what comes next. And amazingly, Twitter did not ban me immediately at that time. So and
they didn't they say something like that it was a tough meeting with the White House and they had some they said use the term mercifully we had answers, that's not a term you use when you're feeling comfortable.
That's right. That's
power
right.
Power dynamic.
That's right. That's right. That is not mercifully the cop let us go.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean
exactly.
Really that's what it is. So they
and you got these emails in discovery, right?
So I, jumping ahead, sued Twitter.
Yeah.
And, you know, amazingly enough, got a judge in, this is in 2022, named William Alsup, who's not a conservative judge.
He's in the
Northern District of California.
Okay.
He's a San Francisco judge, but he's a big tech. He oversaw Google versus Oracle. He's a senior guy. You know, he's in his 70s. He's not afraid to call it like he sees it, call balls and strikes, a real judge.
Yeah.
And he ultimately said, in part because I had these assurances from Twitter, and in part because Twitter had this five-strike policy, that Twitter had essentially modified its contract with me.
So it was a you didn't make constitutional claims in that.
I did. He didn't accept those.
Yeah.
He allowed the case to go forward. He said I'd survived the breach of contract and promissory estoppel.
Right.
But that was enough.
Yeah.
You only have to survive on one thing and then you can go forward.
Right.
And so Twitter ultimately that put, you know, as you know, before you get to the MTD, the company, the defendant has all the power.
That's motion to dismiss.
motion to dismiss, yes, in federal court. If you can survive the motion to dismiss, suddenly as a plaintiff, an individual plaintiff against a big company, you're in a very different position. Because big companies, rightly, are terrified of discovery.
Yeah.
And so Twitter, essentially, you know, they started to negotiate with me. They at first they weren't going to do anything. I mean, we insisted that I get back on. They were going to have to like explain / apologize for what they'd done, which they did. And discovery. We wanted discovery. And so they agreed. And that's where the documents showing the White House papers came out.
Right. Do you think we can also talk about it later too, but do you think that led to the Twitter files that was part of what led to some? Okay.
No, I think
I can't remember exactly how that played out.
That was before the Twitter files. Okay. Amazingly, and this really is amazing because strictly from a news point of view, I'm the only person ever to have forced his way back onto any social media platform as a result of a lawsuit over a ban.
Yeah.
Now, Elon then let people back on, but I'm talking about actually forcing your way back on from the previous management.
Yeah. So,
and by the way, there's no question that would have resulted or that did result in some like changes in terms of Silicon Valley or the companies because the reason Alsup allowed me to move forward, or one reason, was that I did have these communications with this guy, Brandon Borman, who from Twitter, who had told me, go ahead, we want you to talk.
Yeah.
And I promise you, the day after his ruling, you know, Facebook's general counsel or whoever sent memos out to senior people at Facebook saying, don't contact individual users and make any promises to them because it can modify our contract. So,
I want to ask you one. Yes. So when did this come? When was this?
So the ban, I filed the lawsuit over the ban in December 2021. Also ruled in April 2022.
Okay. Yeah,
Twitter put me back on in July 2022. The media wrote about it never.
Yeah.
And they simply blackballed all of it. It's really incredible.
Yeah.
People don't know the story at all. And people still say, they say, well, Elon let you back on. And I said, actually, then I have to tell the whole story. Or sometimes I just nod and say, okay.
Yeah.
But But it's this is a classic example of what media bias looks like right now. It's just, we're just not going to tell the story because it makes it clear this guy's not nuts.
Yeah.
So it's just, we're just rather call him a conspiracy theorist. But going back to the spring and summer of 2021, spring 2021, they already want me off. And Twitter pushes back. And I think, you know, May, June, they're happy. Yeah. They think they've won. They think cases, I mean, you know, one, it would have been good if they'd won. It would have been good if I'd been humiliated because it would have meant no more COVID.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the vaccines fail. And that is a massive freak out.
Yeah.
Because they're aware they've made a promise to the base and to everybody that this is the end of COVID.
Yeah.
And they're aware that that's not happening.
Yeah, that was so. I was not as early as you. I didn't actually join Twitter till September of 2020 because I hated social media. But I had I was very, very critical as soon as I started using it. That's why I created the account of lockdowns and masks.
Yes.
But I never got censored for anything. It was the vaccines. And as soon as I tweeted anything skeptical about the vaccines, I started getting censored. And that was what led me to start looking at this issue. And so the case I brought was I started a couple of months later, but I didn't sue the social media companies, in part because my office doesn't do that. We only sue the government. There had been these, as I'm sure you know, some of these high up government officials like Jen Psaki, Joe Biden himself, the Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, who had been, you know, bragging openly to the public about how they were in touch with social media companies, flagging posts, telling them to take things down. I think Joe Biden publicly blamed you for.
The famous comment was July 16th. It was that week was when things went crazy. So July 16th, 2021. Somebody says to Biden as he's walking past, because, you know, he can't have a press conference with the guy. They said, what do you say to the Facebook and other social media companies that are allowing anti-vaccine disinformation? Because, you know, the media, that's not, you know, allowing reasonable questions, but allowing anti-vaccine disinformation. He says, they're killing people.
Yeah.
4 hours later, I got my first notification of a strike. It was actually my second strike, and I was banned for the first time. That is what led to my, I mean, that started the ball rolling, and 6 weeks later I was banned permanently.
Right. And what was it, Fauci who was asked a question about you or somebody?
Yes, in the depot, the Missouri v. Biden depot, and he denied. He didn't, I think he said, I don't remember.
He doesn't remember anything.
No, he doesn't remember
anything. He said we had the counters like 300 times. He said, I don't recall.
He's an old man. He doesn't remember.
Let me ask you, did you ever think, when you sued Twitter, did you think the government was involved? Did you have any idea?
I mean, I didn't know.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have thought, before they started making these public statements in the spring of 2021, I would have actually thought more highly of them.
I guess I knew that they had pushed publicly. Did I know that I'd personally been targeted by Andy Slavitt?
No, I did not.
I mean, it's pretty... I mean, look, there's a lot of problems with Donald Trump, but Donald Trump... When people say, like, he's going to, you know, he says he's going to be a dictator and step on people's civil liberties, I say, okay, great. He may say X, Y, or Z. Which guy has actually targeted Americans? Which guy actually targeted me? Joe Biden, okay? And you could say, well, he did it for the right reasons. No, he did it.
The First Amendment doesn't have a right reasons exception.
That's the whole point of the First Amendment. I mean, you know, but he also targeted 100 million people with mandates.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, not everybody has the sort of, in fact, nobody has the sort of direct evidence that they were censored because of the government that you do, except maybe arguably RFK, although I still think he doesn't have the... In your case, that one email and then the fact that you were taken off right after or shortly after.
So the government said, well, it was 4 months later. First of all, Slavitt, we know. So Slavitt leaves the government, although his government email account remains operational.
Really?
That came out about a month ago.
Oh, wow.
Slavitt left the government in June 2020. One, but he is still essentially Jim Jordan put out all these documents about about a month ago. Facebook believes he's still speaking for the government, essentially as an intermediary through July. His government email account is running for some period of time, and he is still targeting me. By my,
that seems personal at this point. Because who cares about the COVID vaccines now?
Well, no, it was right. It was 2020. Wait,
I thought you meant he's still targeting you
now.
No,
this is all back then. No, now he just wishes I would get hit by a truck, no doubt. To me, and you might or might not agree with this, even if Twitter stood up and said no, even though Twitter stood up and said no in April 2021, my case should end right there. I should win simply because they asked.
Yeah.
That is a violation of my rights.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It gets very complicated in Missouri versus Biden because, first of all, they argue that if it wasn't coercion, it was okay. I mean, they say it wasn't coercion. None of it was coercion. But also to the extent there were sort of cooperative partnerships going on, which some of the censorship was a result of cooperative partnerships, at least apparently. I think there's an inherent power imbalance and, you know, the threats made in the background that make that questionable. But you do have like people at Facebook reaching out to CDC and saying, hey, what kind of stuff should we be censoring? And they're like, this kind of stuff. So one of the fights we're having now, and it was very apparent at the oral argument in the Supreme Court, is, you know, well, can the government sort of work cooperatively with companies to censor speech? And our position is no. The First Amendment says the government shall not abridge the freedom of speech. Abridge. So the government shouldn't be taking steps to silence people or silence narratives or anything. So I guess if it's harder if you're saying there was no effect.
I would say, first of all, there was an effect.
No, I'm saying in your hypothetical where Twitter is like, fuck off, you know.
But I actually don't think that's true. I think that, I mean, there's many analogies you can use. But suppose the White House had a press conference at a Hilton and Joe Biden was going to speak. And they said to the Hilton the day before, we don't want Alex Berenson there. He asked the wrong kind of questions. Even if the Hilton, and by the way, Hilton, don't forget, like, we do a lot of business with you. And Hilton said, you know what? Well, he's a guest. He's allowed to come to the press conference.
Yeah.
Nobody would have a problem understanding why that is a problem and a First Amendment violation. And that's the exact, it's a close analogy.
Yeah, I mean, and I think you could probably argue that the chilling effect is there then. So even if Twitter says, you know, fuck off this one time, the fact that the government is putting this pressure on them might,
And there's no question, again, like, I think the government backed off a little bit, not because they didn't want to censor me, but because they didn't think they needed to in May and June. But when it hit the fan in July, they publicly at this point said, you know, again, Biden says they're killing people. A White House PR person says 4 days later, Section 230 is on the table.
Right.
I mean, that's in Missouri v. Biden. Yeah. And you can see, again, with the documents that Jordan released a few days ago about Facebook, that in mid-July, Facebook was feeling the pressure. So what we don't have the same documents right now from Twitter. Maybe we will get them at some point.
I mean, Musk has said that he would just release them, but look, maybe Twitter didn't have this. I mean, we know
it seems impossible.
It does. I mean, the Facebook emails that came out around a year ago were pretty shocking. They said someone very high up told Nick Clegg, who's the head of global affairs, I think, at Facebook, he's asking the person to remind him why they censored the lab leak theory, and the person says, because we were under pressure from the White House, we shouldn't have done it. So that's pretty clear evidence that that a lot of the censorship was going on was, you know, because of the government. And just as a little background too, I mean, the basic premise is the Constitution only applies to the government. You know this obviously, but it doesn't apply to private parties like Twitter or Facebook in a sort of technical manner, but the government can't try to circumvent the Constitution by using private entities to do what it can't. And I think the best analogy is to the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures, including warrantless ones. So the government can't search your house without a warrant, but the government also can't go hire a private company to search your house without a warrant, because if they could do that, what would be the point of the Constitution? They could just outsource everything to private companies. So there's not a lot of law on this sort of specific issue, I think in part because social media changes how things worked. I mean, before social media, you could have, and this came up actually a lot at the oral argument in the Supreme Court. You know, the government does call up newspapers and say, hey, can you not print that article? Or even in stronger terms, if you print that article, we're going to come after you with, you know,
right.
whatever. And that happened in the Pentagon Papers case. But I think one major distinction, even if that's okay, and I don't know that it is, the government claims that it is, even if that's okay, it's a little bit, it's quite different because there the government is putting pressure on the party. The newspaper gets to make decisions about
yes.
its own speech. It's not third parties who don't even know these conversations are taking place. So it would be different if the government called you and said, hey, Alex, we think it's like the best for the country if you stop tweeting. Will you please do that? And then you have the ability to make that decision.
Yep.
But when they're using this third party to censor you behind your back, essentially, that's a very different scenario.
And by the way, they never did that. I mean, yeah. I don't know that they ever did that to anybody. Maybe RFK
I don't
Jr.
Know.
Got
no,
a call.
I don't. Or I know of nobody. I mean, I talked to almost everybody who's right. involved in these lawsuits, and I've heard of nobody.
That right. So they clearly preferred to not
yeah.
to use these backdoor means.
Yeah, yeah. And I think in part, I mean, another reason they weren't entirely forthcoming, although they were more forthcoming than you would think they'd be about what was going on, is that they knew it was unconstitutional. I mean, these and a lot of the emails that have come out in your case and in Missouri are pretty shocking. Like Rob Flaherty emailing these companies and saying, if you don't do this, you know, Andy Slavitt said, like, we're going to be considering our options.
Yep.
Yeah, Rob Flaherty, I mean, do this and do this now.
Yeah, it's veiled threats, but not very veiled.
No.
So you are going to get a decision in Missouri v. Biden
soon. Yeah.
And I know there's this question about standing. I know.
Yeah.
That, yeah. So
yeah. So where is your case now, actually?
So it's essentially waiting for Missouri v. Biden.
I see.
Obviously, if the Supreme Court says that, you know, what happened to your plaintiffs is censorship, then I'm going to win.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If they don't, it may depend on do they say standing? Do they kick it back down? What happens with it? I mean, last week, I had a very good case. Last week, the Supreme Court made a very good decision for me.
For Fulo.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so
I wrote an amicus brief in
that. Yeah. That case, you know, that's again about using third parties, in this case, insurance companies and banks, to pressure the NRA, which, you know, speech, obviously, the state of New York did not like.
Yeah.
And it's a very important case on a couple of levels, both for what it says and because, you know, Sotomayor wrote the decision.
And it was a unanimous decision.
And it was a unanimous decision. And it's Second Circuit.
Yeah.
And Sotomayor wrote a case 20 years ago in the Second Circuit called Aquitti versus Molinari.
The billboard case.
The billboard which is our favorite case in the Second Circuit, because it says that the Molinari was the borough president of Staten Island, and he got mad because a church group, you know, a little radical church group, put up a billboard with anti-gay slogans on it, and people didn't like that. So he wrote the billboard company as the borough president of Staten Island and said, yeah. I think he said you have economic interests in Staten Island or something like
we're
that.
We're going to have to reconsider if we're going to work with you if you're going to keep these billboards up.
Yes, and the billboard company ultimately pulled the billboard, and the Second Circuit said, because back in the day, liberals believed in free speech, even if the free speech was anti-gay slogans.
Right.
And Sotomayor said, that's no good. And guess what? You know, 20 years later, that principle doesn't apply if it's the NRA, but the Supreme Court still remembers.
Right.
So from our point of view, it's very good what happened with NRA v. Volo.
Yeah.
And obviously I'm hopeful that you will win too.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be best for all of us. I mean, and there, you know, it's not just a win lose. There are various things that could happen. I mean, for instance, they could say the standard is coercion. So the companies can work with the government if they want to censor speech, which I think would be pretty disastrous in terms of its practical implications for free speech in the country.
Right, but I don't think would necessarily get my case booted or anything.
No,
like that.
I mean, your case, I think, would have to go back for more fact-finding, because they would then want to say, okay, we're going to find out whether or not you were kicked off because of coercion, or maybe Twitter just decided ultimately that they wanted to do the right thing.
And yeah, right. I mean, you know,
the right thing.
Yeah, no, it's so we'll see. But obviously, if the Supreme Court decides in favor of your plaintiffs, I don't see how my case doesn't move ahead.
Yeah, yeah. But there are a lot of iterations. And I think I try not to make predictions, but I think most likely they're going to say, sending it back for more fact finding. This is the standard. It's going to sound something like what came out of Vulo.
That okay, you know,
which
what
I think wouldn't be bad.
No, yeah, yeah. But again, you know,
that would allow for more discovery. And
yes, and believe me, the defendants, whether it's the U.S. government Slavitt or the two Pfizer defendants, because Pfizer, a guy named Scott Gottlieb, who was at the FDA, the head of the FDA, who then left under Trump, by the way, then left and became you know, he's a CNBC commentator. He's on the Pfizer board. He wrote a book about COVID, and he was buddies with Slavitt. But from my point of view, what really matters is he was on the Pfizer board. Got involved with trying to get me banned. Also,
he's the defendant in your case.
He's
right?
A defendant. Well, yes, he ultimately contacted Twitter, and that the night that they banned me. So right. That was really the whether or not Slavitt, you know, had talked to him directly. These are things that are, to me, at the very least, we have to get discovery on these issues. And so, I think it is fact intensive. These folks certainly don't want us to get past the motion to dismiss.
Yeah, yeah, no, they definitely don't. actually, Amy Comey Barrett asked an interesting question at the argument, which was, well, what if the companies said this is a once in a lifetime pandemic? And we can probably dispute that, but accepting that premise, we're just going to turn over our content moderation policies to the government. Would that be okay? And the government actually conceded that wouldn't be, which was somewhat hopeful for at least having her vote.
Interesting.
That the sort of cooperative agreements we saw so much with the CDC and the CISA, which doesn't affect your case so much because that's much more about election related censorship.
I mean, so again, I did not see the oral arguments in Missouri v. Biden, but my understanding is that Kavanaugh was sort of the big surprise.
He was like, oh, I don't know, I worked in the government, we used to do this all the time. We called up the newspapers and told them they better not publish a story, and we're like, well, maybe
you shouldn't have done that.
Did you ever? Yeah, that was surprising. I mean, the three liberals weren't at all. Sotomayor, Jackson, and why is this slipping my mind right now? It's another woman. Oh, Kagan.
Oh, right.
they were, you know, we expected them not to be friendly at all. But the swing votes are it's Barrett, Kavanaugh, and Roberts,
right.
Who was seemed sort of, I didn't get much of a read on him. He didn't.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So, well, speaking of terrible people like Scott Gottlieb, did you watch the recent hearings with Fauci and Dr. Morenz?
I mean, I didn't watch all of it, but I read everything I could, and I watched chunks of it. And I've read all the emails. I don't know how much time we have. We've been talking a long time already.
I know. It's really up to you.
So, this is probably, let's leave it at this. This is the most amazing thing. I mean, there's so much amazing in the emails that have come out about how, you know, David Morenz just didn't care about FOIA. I mean, FOIA's a law, right? Like, it's amazing. And, you know, at the time.
Well, also, obviously they were trying to hide something. Well, okay, you go.
And again, you don't know what they were trying to hide, right? We'll find out, right?
Yeah.
But we hope. But so Morenz, you know, again, when I was at the Times, I would I covered a lot of white collar crime. I wrote stories, this is not an exaggeration, that got executives sent to prison, that led to prosecutions that got executives sent to prison. Those documents are some of the worst that I've ever seen, because usually people come up with some half-hearted excuse for what they're doing.
Yeah.
And Morenz is he just says over and over again, we're gonna avoid FOIA. I don't like it. We're gonna skip it. I'm going to hand documents to Fauci.
Well, the best part was his emails actually showed that Fauci wasn't. I mean, he said, Tony's too smart to.
That's right. Tony's not going to let himself get caught is basically what it said.
Yeah, and he said secret back channel. Yeah. Tony uses a secret back channel.
You know,
He gets up on, before Congress and says, oh, I was joking and exaggerating. Even the Democrats had had it with him, right?
Yeah.
But so the put all that aside, okay? Yeah. The greatest thing in the emails that were released, the Morin's emails, and Morin's clearly loves Tony Fauci. You know, he's a true, you know, courtier to Fauci. The way he talks about Fauci as this, like, princeling who has to be handled with kid gloves, who you have to make it his idea, because if you tell him, he's going to say no just to say no. And if you don't have a Nobel Prize, he's not even going to listen to you. I mean, it's just everything bad that I thought about. To go all the way back to Twitter in the beginning. So I had these Department of Pandemia tweets that, you know, some of them were, you know, they were quite rash back in the day. But more recently, I have the bulletin from Dr. Anthony Fauci tweets. And they're written in these all caps screaming tone where Fauci is constantly referring to people as peasants and demanding his Nobel Prize. And it turns out that that's actually how Tony Fauci sees the world.
I'm sure it is.
And, you know, he hates Rand Paul because Rand Paul is a doctor. So, you know, doctors only truly respect other doctors. Yeah. This is what you learn if you're married to a doctor. Doctors only truly respect other doctors. And Rand Paul will not bend the knee.
Yeah.
And so Fauci hates him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's obvious. Well, I very much enjoyed those emails, especially. Did you read the blonde nymphomaniac?
Yes! And more, I mean, and take a look at Morin's. Morin's a blonde nymphomaniac. He'd be lost. I'm not going to make any jokes.
Well, he knows he said something like about a blonde nymphomaniac bringing him drinks. And then he said, or at my age, I'll take a brunette or a redhead or any hair at all.
That's right.
I was actually insulted by that with the brunette thing, but okay.
but I mean, he, you know, and every third email has a reference to him getting drunk. You know,
I know. There was like the olives at the bottom of the martini glass.
Pour yourself a second one. I mean, this guy.
The emails do make more sense if you're drunk when you write them.
Yeah, that's true. Some of the stuff he said. But, you know, will they get Fauci? They, you know, who knows? First of all, who knows what there is to get? But they will only get
Well, there's something. You're not like they're trying to hide something. I don't know what it is or more than one thing.
Yes, or more than one
you're
thing.
You're not so obsessive about secret back channels if you don't have something ultimately that you're trying to hide
and getting stuff handed to you. I mean, so the question is, will Morin's or somebody else flip? And so far that has not happened.
Well, maybe he'll get upset when he sees Fauci throws him under the bus, which he did
the other day
on Monday. I knew he was going to do that. It was like he's gonna say, I don't know what this guy Morin's is talking about, like
senior scientific advisor. We just use that term for janitor. That guy picked up my bubble gum. So, I mean, anyway, it's like we're joking about this. This is a cover up of a virus that killed 10 million old people.
Yeah, yeah.
And 100 young people.
What I think is that Fauci did have, at least, you know, through his work with the EcoHealth Alliance, was partially responsible for development of the coronavirus, which was probably why he reacted so strongly to it, because he was like, oh, shit.
I think I won't go that far.
You won't?
I think it's more likely that he got, and I think he knows more now. I think what's very likely is that he got scared. That he knew that there were these links to EcoHealth Alliance. He knew what he had said publicly about gain of function research, and he was worried.
Yeah.
And, you know,
so you think he was just worried that he had sort of gotten the lab leak hypothesis wrong?
No, I think he was worried that it was possible that EcoHealth had played some role, because Daszak is, you know, this crazy cowboy and pushing this stuff, and that because of his relationship. Well, not his really, but NIH's relationship with EcoHealth, and because of what he had said about gain of function, it was going to look very bad.
Yeah.
I think that's the best case. I think what you're saying there was more direct is also a possibility.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll find out.
It'd be nice to know, wouldn't it? I mean, this is American taxpayer money that, again, may have indirectly led to the creation of a virus that really blew up the world for 2 years.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And Fauci kills beagles.
And Fauci kills beagles.
That was my favorite part of the Monday's hearing. So I just wrote something on Twitter like, now Marjorie Taylor Greene is accusing Fauci of killing beagles. It was just a sentence. I didn't actually, you know, I didn't say whether or not I thought it was true. And people got so mad at me. They were like, he does kill beagles. Are you aware of this experiment?
There's no... I, Yes. Yeah. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this was great.
Yeah, this was great. Thank you so much.